talk today a little bit, as we always do, in a sense. What else do we talk about but the human condition? Emphasizing one particular aspect of it. The great picture of this human condition that we live in, unique it seems from other organisms, is that we have this capacity, which we call self-consciousness, which really is a reflection of that we live in a world of separation and duality. And we have turned this attitude of consciousness, awareness, upon a mass of fictions. And we have an enormous capacity in our minds, which I've referred to so many years as the construction business, which is constantly scurrying about to create what we call understandings and meanings and so on. Not to mind that we have to name everything and put everything in its proper place and find what the right rules are to do things and so on and so on. And this is all a function of the construction business, which is a subset of this duality. As far as we know, porcupines don't do it, sparrows don't do it, trees don't do it, clouds don't do it. Nothing else in this world, as far as we know, does that kind of thing. We are absolutely unique. And we also have a little seed in ourselves, which in Sanskrit is called the bija, the little seed. And that seed is the possibility of, we say, being liberated, coming to know our Buddha nature, our fundamental nature. And it is the function of the great spiritual traditions, and particularly focused as we are on Zen, to nurture that seed and finally allow it to manifest in our being and become the means by which something different, but latent in all of us, can manifest in the world. So it's one of the essential things about our practice is that it requires an immense honesty. Immense honesty. This is not the commonplace honesty of not prevaricating, trying to conceal what actually happened. This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about a huge admission of what is so. This is an essential for each individual towards themselves, and it is the marvelous basis of the relationship between a Zen teacher and a sincere student. This immense honesty. Of course, on both sides. I've had people over the years who have come to me and they said, we want the truth. I want the truth. But what they really want is not the truth that they're willing to shed blood for. To have the immense honesty of admitting what is really so for themselves. But rather they want to have some verification or affirmation that what they think is so, is so. And so when I say certain things, they say, oh, that's what I wanted to hear. That immediately reveals where they're coming from. And that is what we do. We have a structure in the mind created by this business, this construction business for everything, everything without exception. Buddhism, ourselves, life, not to mind trees, cars and whatever, and other people in our lives. When we say we know them, what we mean is that we have a construction in our minds, and how very extremely rare it is to admit that. And instead it is projected upon the world. It is, becomes a filter, a screen through which we view the world. There is an old saying, you know, we have to see it to believe it. And that's not true. What happens is that people see what they believe. It is the structure through which they view this world that becomes what they say reality is, including of themselves. I am this kind of a person, that kind of a person, unworthy person, worthy person, strong person, weak person, whatever it is. This is turned everywhere. So we, human beings, being the heritors of this great tradition of Zen, have to realize it's the immense revolutionary fact of Zen. It does not deal with statements about reality. It does not feed that part of us that wants to understand shamelessly says that a person can come to realize in their own being this fundamental nature, this what we call Buddha nature, this liberation from all this process in one lifetime. Buddhism itself, if we could use this word, sins immensely by generating, for example, if you study Buddhism, study the Buddhist philosophy texts and all that, you find that they postulate 52 stages through which, they say, an individual has to pass in order to become a full Buddha. And they have all these ones named. Zen is talking about transcending all of this. This is all nonsense. What does it do but feed this mind that loves to do that sort of thing? And likewise, it talks about love. And it says it has this characteristic and that characteristic and this, and they all are nicely named. Maitri, Karuna, and so on. And it's all a sop, you might say, to this mind that wants to have its construction business maintained and still holds on to the belief that this is the way to find truth. Zen says that the way is quite different. The way is not through the intellect, we say, through words, but what are they based upon? They are based upon this separation and construction business and the verification by matching these up to the world that what we have constructed in our minds is right. Now, I'm not denying that this process is immensely valuable. As you all know, I always say this, so I'm going to talk about pulling the rug out from under it. That it is immensely valuable. It has created all these products of civilization for good or for ill. They first arose in the mind as an image, and then they were strategized and materialized in the world. And it can be immensely useful. Of course, of course. For part of our life is living in this karmic situation, just as it is for porcupines and sparrows and trees. Except, contrary to the postulates of the Farmer's Almanac, squirrels do not know that the winter is going to be cold and therefore that they accumulate nuts. Nor do woolly bears put on a heavier coat and thus help us beings who are so narrow-minded to predict what the next winter will be like. Contrary to all of that, we propose something very different. We propose awakening this little seed in us. This little seed that cannot just be pulled around by this construction business and find the comfort in the familiarity of these things that we think we know, including those things we think we know about Buddhism and Zen, but taking a different stance towards it all. How marvelous! How marvelous that is when you come to think of it. How radical it is that Zen proposes skepticism. It promotes doubt. It promotes not believing anything at all. And coupling that with trust, sometimes called faith. All of this is the characteristic of this little seed, this little bija, rumbling inside a person until its time is ripe, until it gets, you might say, to the threshold that starts it to manifest in the form of what we call practice. This is not true for everyone. And it is, in fact, as you all know, in Buddhism stated as something very rare, the image being that of a blind turtle swimming in the ocean and finally finding that one piece of wood that has a hole in it and putting his head through that hole. They say it is as rare as that for this little bija, this little seed, to start its rumbling and start its work, to give rise to what is possible for every human being to manifest in themselves. We call this Buddha nature. We call this liberation. Liberation from what? Liberation from the strictures of the phantoms of the mind. With which people ordinarily, totally, and 100% preoccupy themselves with. Now, this construction business does things that we say in our humorous way are good enough for government work. That is to say, they let you get through life. And for many people, that is all that life is. It is a matter of getting through it. Got through another day. Got through another year. Getting through it. Managing. But so many people, and this is the beginning of the aura of this little bija in this being, feel a deep dissatisfaction. A deep, it's not enough. A deep, and it can turn into depression, can turn into other fantasies, anxiety, paranoia, whatever. But a depression, which is the emotional correlate of separation, as is boredom. Separation. They feel that. They feel the depth of that. I talk with people, I manage my life, but somehow I feel out of contact. I feel it's meaningless. The search, as many books have it, the search for meaning. Zen has nothing to do with this search for meaning, because it looks at what is the source of this search of meaning. It does this for everything about our human life. What is the source of it? What is underneath it? Now we have to use all the tools that we have. Once this little bija is awakened to, and this is true of us, no one can liberate us. There is no use trying to look through the world for the great enlightened master who's going to do this for you. But all you're doing is you have some structure in the mind of what enlightenment is, what an enlightened master is, and you go through the world searching for such a thing. Many of you know that. And it's an absolute waste of time. Very human, very understandable, but an absolute waste of time. An absolute waste of time learning all the rules and the rituals of traditional Buddhism. An absolute waste of time. Not only a waste of time, an obstruction. What spiritual discipline in the world, apart from those little small ones that reside in each of the great traditions, and of which Zen is the great flowering? Which of them will say, the way to come to realization, the way to come to spiritual truth, is to get rid of everything we've taught you? Get rid of all the stories, all the Jesus and his the vicarious sacrifice, and get rid of all the rituals and so on and so on. And get rid of all the fancy things that you have with written out in your tankas, and all the images of various qualities of human beings, all the elephant Ganeshas, everything. Get rid of it all. If you have the courage, if you have awakened that little seed, thus having something, that faith, that supports this activity. Otherwise, it becomes just iconoclasm and can lead to craziness. But as long as there is that little seed that is coupled with the deep desire to know what it really is all about, and is willing, therefore, to see through and be helped to see through everything that you conceived that was in the way, this radical, radical movement towards absolute and total nakedness, encountering the world, as we say, just as it is, not just as your ideas about it are, just as it actually is. How to find that? It requires that this little bija starts doing something different. Starts observing, and thus we see the foundation of all of productive Buddhist meditation, and indeed of the meditations within Christianity and so on also. And Advaita Vedanta and all the other places where it begins to manifest. It happens that Zen is the most blatant and uncompromising flowering of this. To start to witness, to observe, to establish a place from which one can observe. That is that little place. That little place is a place that finally grows and finally becomes what we call nirvana. It finally becomes what we call the other side of the coin. It finally blossoms and explodes into the realization of what is really so. What is so? In the light of which all else is seen to be stories. And you don't deny them. You don't go out and burn story buildings and whatever. But you see it. And the seeing of it gives rise to many things. And one of those things I want to talk about today, one of those things that this persistent activity in seeing through relentlessly, honestly, and without holding anything back of all these phantoms that fill the mind, and all these constructions, and all these stories, every last one of them, even though it be called something like Buddhism, the holy work, no matter what it is, to so trust this that can finally reveal itself in you and in everyone, that you are willing to do anything that is necessary in order to really know it. What I mean by honesty is exemplified by Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma came before the Emperor Wu, and the Emperor Wu, after Bodhidharma had said some things that the Emperor couldn't understand at all, finally asked him, "Who are you?" And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." That This is an example of this immense honesty. This, as you pursue this work, gets to manifest everywhere. It gets to manifest not only about yourself. I don't know. It's honest. You have stories, but then you see through them all. They're only stories. You have to select certain things and string them together. And they don't breathe you. They don't circulate your blood. They don't walk you. They don't produce your words. They don't do anything except console you, give you something to present to others in the hopes that they won't challenge it, because you have no idea in this world what you'd do if they challenged it. Unless you've started to allow to grow in yourself that which was so full in Bodhidharma. So, this honesty. Everything must be looked into. Take nothing as a final conclusion. Nothing whatsoever. Be willing to do that. This exploration, this courage. Courage comes from the root, linguistically, for heart. You have to have that heart, that alive center, that place that will keep you moving and give you the life that comes from this process and the alignment with it. The thing I want to talk about specifically is a line in the Shenzhen Ming that kind of bothers people. And that is, when love and hate both disappear, all things are clear and undisguised. People still addicted to their structures of the world think they know what love and hate is, and they can really be in accordance with you when you say, hate, you want that to disappear. Yes, that's a good thing, good thing. I'd love to get rid of all that hate. Bad, bad. But love? And then you realize that the Shenzhen Ming puts them together, love and hate. There must be something similar about them. And indeed there is. For those things that ordinarily pass for love and hate are based on something similar, which is a comparison between a structure in the mind of about that particular person, in this case, as love and hate are usually about people. We don't usually hate trees, but some people do, I guess. It's usually about people. You have an idea in your mind of what that person is. And you're not willing to be honest enough to admit that it's just a construction purely. You've never lived within the skin of that person, so you can't possibly be an expert on them. So whatever you say about them is a lie. Of course it is. But people operate that way. They have an image in their minds about the world and about other people. And when the other people behave in a certain way that matches their internal movies of how they think the world is and how they'd like it to turn out, then they can say match. They can say it's a match, I like, and finally it gets to the extreme of I love. But scratch it just a little bit. As we all know from the proliferation, I don't know what the percentage is these days of divorces, but it's pretty damned high. Not to mind other more violent acts of people switching their opinions about somebody or something. And it turns into hate and worse. Murderous hate sometimes. For the same mechanism. There's a shift. Oh, I was mistaken. She, he is not this. They're that. And they don't realize that's just another story that they've created. It's psychologists is called a threshold effect. That the exceptions build up, and then shift, it goes over threshold, and a new story is built based on what previously was considered to be an exception. But they become now the rule, and the other things that were considered to be the rule become the exception, and a new story is built, and hate develops, and everything that follows from that. And it's very, you might say, simple-minded. Very obvious. It's what people do. But there are, none of it is based upon actually witnessing another person without the construction business in between, without any screens, just seeing that person, hearing that person, starting to know this person. Requires all sorts of things, requires non-judgment, requires the admission that that person could not be otherwise at this moment, requires the erosion of all these things that have been the familiar, commonplace ideas in the human mind that are an immense form of arrogance, that we know. Don't tell me anything different, I know. Enormous arrogance that fills human beings who are populated in their minds by all these phantoms and all these stories and all these construction businesses to which reality has been given. Unwittingly. Nobody chooses to do it. It's done unwittingly. Without choice. Without awareness. And this little bija that grows is the seed of awareness. It's a seed of awareness. As this awareness grows and as one realizes that one has no real logical or experiential foundation for believing that things could have been different in the past. None whatsoever. And you cannot find it. Nor, if you look inside, can you find any self. All you find is stories, ideas, accumulations of traditional things that you've given the name I or we. This is honesty. This is the investigation. This is one of the third great pillars of Zen. Rare it is, just as this turtle swimming in the ocean, getting its head through that hole in the blind turtle, getting its head through that hole in that piece of wood that floats in the ocean. Rare indeed it is for people to combine and persist one of the other great three pillars of Zen, this determination and persistence, to carry through, to have enough of a valuing of this, really wanting to know that you are willing to persist. You are willing to do whatever is necessary. And as you do, what happens mysteriously in one's being is this trust grows. This kind of sense inside that makes sense at some deep level that I can't really specify. I can't put into a story, but it makes sense. We might say it feels right. It's whatever it is that keeps you moving. And gradually that grows. It grows more into a certainty. You get the not just the emanations, but the little flashes that substantiate there's something real in this. And that keeps one moving. It is the fuel. It may be something you read, something you've seen, someone you've met, whatever it is. This is the fuel that keeps this thing moving and keeps that little bija sprouting and growing and developing the ability to look underneath, not to be caught, not to be grabbed, engaged by these phantoms in the mind that are so commonplace, that are so much a part of this, what we call the human condition. But the human condition, as this bija starts to grow, also includes what this bija is all about, includes this witnessing, includes this living from another place, little by little. Living from a place that's like a mountaintop where you see things. And then you contract again. And things that you expand, you contract, you expand, you contract. And every time you contract, you notice that you are contracting and that allows an expansion. Gradually, you learn about what it is to be a human being. And you learn what it is to move along this so-called path of Zen. This is the marvel of it. It is the unending marvel of it. Now, when love and hate both disappear, all things are clear and undisguised. When this, that is the foundation of that kind of love and hate, disappears, that is the comparison, the arrogance of believing that you know the other person, when that disappears, what is it replaced by? What is the source of real love? Well, part of it is the extension of this very practice that has been awakened in you as this little bija grows, which is witnessing. Witnessing without judgment. Just seeing and hearing. And what a marvelous thing it is. What a great gift it is to another person to just give them your presence. That you are really here for them. I really see you as best I can. Verify for me if what I think is correct. Help me to really step into your world. For the first time, how often does that happen? For how many of you here has anyone ever sat before you and said anything like that? It is very rare. You are fortunate if it has happened, because it is very rare. People believe that they know another person because they know some examples of what their preferences are, what they've done in certain circumstances, and they've made a whole string of generalizations and things like that that they believe is the other person. And it leaves the other person in a state of isolation because they deeply know they are not known. They are not known. They are alone and unknown. And inside, there's some little piece of that bija that helps a person to be aware. And this is part of faith. This is part of this trust. This sniffing, as I often use the image, you sniff that there's a smell of baking bread and you know that there is a bakery nearby. These little sniffs of the possibility of not being isolated, of not being alone, the immense possibility that maybe there are no separate objects at all, that there is only one great reality, and that we not only participate in it, but that is what we are. The little hints that start to give rise to that possibility in the being. Thus, you read things where those things are said, or you hear people say those things that know for themselves, and you go, yes, I understand that. That's starting to happen for me. Those things, this is this process. This is this marvelous thing called Zazen, for which there are no boundaries, nor any beginning nor ending. It becomes the fabric and substance of one's life. Not sitting on a cushion all the time, not with one's eyes down all the time, but gradually the qualities of that grow in one's being. The awareness, the knowing, the consolations of one's true self start to become evident. And they move into a real knowing of what love can be. One of the aspects of love that is commonly specified in Buddhism, this sad, human, unfortunate thing that is called Buddhism, that specifies this one aspect called Maitri. Chögyam Trungpa, with whom I worked for a while, developed a training, a very marvelous idea behind it. Didn't quite work out appropriately because he didn't have enough enlightened people to work with it, people that could really manifest non-judgment and so on. But what was meant to do was to stimulate for any individual by means of certain things, certain rooms and certain physical environments in which they would be, in which they voluntarily place themselves, that would accentuate certain propensities in their being until they came to a certain extreme, where then they were taken into the and enfolded, as it were, within a group that would give them non-judgment and listening, and just seeing and hearing. This is Maitri. Maitri. This is not erotic love. This is not even brotherly love. In Greek, eros and philos. This is more like charitas. This is more like cherishing this person just as they are. Learning how in oneself to drop away the judgment that comes from the arrogance of believing that you know how things are and they weren't that way, so therefore, and so on. That transformation within oneself, and this, of course, is an aspect of real love, that real love requires a transformation within one's own being before it can be appreciated or manifested by another person. A transformation into this space of non-judgment and a space of this serenity and, in fact, joy in being in this life just the way it is. And this was meant to help the individuals, this Maitri process, Maitri training it was called, to transform based on principles we don't need to go into. That was one aspect. And this is one aspect of this real love, not the love that's based on comparison, but the love that looks out at the world. As you walk down the street, you realize, there I am. This is another manifestation of this wondrous human being, of which I too am a little island in this one reality of human being. And I don't know them. But I observe and I listen. Because it's an enormous gift to be able to see through the eyes, hear through the ears of another person. Thus we grow in this karmic world. Another aspect of this love traditionally specified in Buddhism is karuna, which is called compassion. Compassion, most people do not understand what compassion is. It's not merely the assuagement of the pain of another. It can turn into pity, which is pathetically insulting of another person. Let me help you. And done without knowledge can lead to resistance on the part of the person to whom such motivation is directed, because they will see it as a put down. Poor thing, you can't do it for yourself. Let me show you how to do it. Poor thing. And people use that term, poor thing. We've all heard it. This is not compassion. Compassion is vast and wide. Compassion is this embracing of what it is to be a human being, starting with oneself and holding in that cherishing and understanding and warm way all the things that arise in one's being, all the activities of the phantoms, all the activities of these processes that go on in the mind, holding them, realizing, yes, this is what it is to be a human being, that these things occur. And strangely enough, doing that does not solidify them, but allows them to undergo a very benevolent kind of melting. It is so, in a sense, but not with any sense of put-down. So what? So that's what courses through the mind. That's what courses through this field of consciousness. So given from a place of arrogance, from a stance of knowing what things really are, quotes, that arrogant place, this can be a put-down. But coming from the place where already it is opening and melting, it comes from a realization that all beings are subject to this vast flow of these phantoms, these constructions, these things that arise out of emptiness, take form, transform, and disappear back into emptiness, and new things come up, like that. Unpredictable, uncontrollable. It just is. And strangely enough, as one cultivates that attitude towards all these things, they lose their power. The phantoms are perceived for what they are, substanceless. They are real, yes, they have had that, those great effects. And they have great effects on all beings that experience them, but they have no substance. And gradually, their effect on one, that's their reality, becomes less and less powerful and finally dissolves. Because it is in the dissolving light of realizing they have no substance. They have no substance. I has no substance. I and me have no substance. Right and wrong. They have no substance except I live in a political and social world where these things have to be regarded well because of the smooth movement through this particular world that's constructed the way it is now. But they have no substance. They're all the constructions of human beings, and that's all right. All these things, that's all they are. And love and hate of that traditional sort, based upon this comparison, dissolve away, and all things become clear and undisguised. There are many aspects of love, other than what I've mentioned, but those I wanted to especially mention. We don't need to go into the other aspects, the love, the particularity. We can mention only in passing the cherishing that one develops towards everything. The shine on the door handle, the sound of the door as it opens, the feel of the foot on the floor, the cherishing of this, this experience of this right now. The realization in one's being, not anymore an idea of any sort, but an experienced reality, that this is where all of life is now, this cherishing. And because it's nowhere else, the whole orientation of consciousness is towards this now, this person in front of you. This is enormous and of immense possibility. There is no need to imagine what this would be like if it were more common. What is important, as was said one time, to cultivate one's own garden. Cultivate these qualities as best one can within oneself. And they all derive from this essence of Zazen, from this witnessing, from this relentless looking into what is the reality of this? Does it have any substance whatsoever? We'll end there today.